Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
We know, basically, how to close an economy. We know, in theory, even if we're not doing it right, how to reopen an economy. Quite possibly our next test, reclosing that self-same economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 24th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. One hesitates to anthropomorphize the stock market, especially given that thing that I always say about it. But it did seem to be trying to make a point today to say something specifically. Whoa. Everybody just slow down. States have reopened in varying degrees. Testing and virus numbers and hospitalizations and also deaths are rising in a lot of places. And it sure seems traders got the memo for today anyway, because it's always a brand new adventure at the corner of Wall Street and Broad when that opening bell goes in the mornings, right? But while we may be done with the virus is clearly not done with this economy. And so the conversation is turning from reopening to reclosing, more lockdowns. And whether it makes sense to at least partially even reclose some businesses, say restaurants. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra looked into how that might work.
Well, the first time this happened in March, it wasn't pretty. Restaurant owners found out all of a sudden they had to shut down dine-in service. And when that happens, to start, you have way more food than you need to fulfill takeout orders.
What do you do with it long term? You could try to sell it off to supermarkets.
Mike Haller is a manager at UL Everclean, which advises restaurants on food safety. Or you could sell the food directly to consumers, turn your restaurant into a little grocery store. You could also freeze the food and hope it stays good for a while. Also, you got to call your suppliers and tell them, actually, I won't be needing those 10 cartons of tomatoes, and I don't know how many I do need.
You know, most of these food facilities, they go off of same store sales, so they can look back in history and find out, like, well, we need so many pounds of shrimp this week. And with these disruptions, that makes it an absolute nightmare for knowing what to order because these are unprecedented times.
Shutting down again would also hurt sales. And a restaurant is not going to make up the difference with takeout. All of this puts small restaurants in particular at risk. Vlad Richter is CEO of the tech platform Zenput. It advises big restaurant chains like Domino's and Sweetgreen. He says if you own one location and it's in a place under mandated lockdown, that could wipe you out.
Especially if you just ordered $10,000 worth of inventory and you had to toss $5,000 of it out because it just, you know, you can't hold it for, you know, 3, 4, 5 weeks or whatever the time period is.
He says the big chains would be in a better position to get through another round of lockdowns because they have lots of cash and lots of locations. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
The global economy, said the International Monetary Fund, today is going from bad to worse. The IMF says it's expecting a nearly 5% contraction in the global economy this year. That's 2 percentage points worse than its earlier guesses. And look, we get that those kind of seemingly random numbers and percentages can sound a little abstract, especially on a global scale. So we asked Marketplace's Justin Ho to do a little compare and contrast.
So the Great Recession back in 2008 and 2009, the world economy contracted by less than 1% back then. Harvard economics professor Ken Rogoff is the IMF's former chief economist. He says a 5% global contraction.
It's like a meteor hitting the earth. It is a massive number.
The IMF says the global economy will contract as people around the world spend less because they're stuck at home. Business activity will drop. All of that means hundreds of millions of lost jobs, especially for low-skilled workers.
The Federal Reserve was calling for near double-digit unemployment at the end of this year. I think we could have double-digit unemployment at the end of next year.
Meanwhile, government debt will rise as countries borrow to prop up their economies. Sebastian Mallaby at the Council on Foreign Relations says that's happening more in developed countries. Countries with emerging economies, say India, Latin America, can't afford to borrow enough to address the effects of the pandemic.
Everything from hunger to lack of access to any kind of assistance from the health system, those kinds of problems are going to be way more acute in the emerging world.
A country's case numbers will also affect how much pain a 5% contraction causes. Economist Jay Bryson at Wells Fargo says in Europe, cases aren't rising like they are here in the U.S.
And so later this year, depending on how things evolve here, Europe could potentially be growing faster than the United States.
The IMF projects that the U.S. economy is likely to fare even worse than the global one. It expects U.S. GDP to drop by 8%. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Wednesday, not so good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We know, because we've been reporting on it, that this still happening pandemic and the still happening economic crisis that it has brought is not affecting all businesses in this economy equally. And there is some new data on that to tell you about. A report from the J.P. Morgan Chase Institute, that's their think tank, finds that while small businesses across all groups have taken a hit, Black-owned businesses saw their cash balances drop 26% by the end of March. That's as compared to 12% for businesses on average. Also, early in this whole thing, while revenues were, as I said, falling for all businesses, it was especially bad for companies owned by Asian Americans. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams is on that one.
COVID-19 drained the cash reserves of small businesses. While Black-owned businesses felt that the most, those owned by Asian people were close behind. Chi Mack is a small business research lead at the J.P. Morgan Chase Institute.
Asian-owned businesses, their cash balances were also down more than 20%, and that's certainly a steeper decline than what we see across all small businesses.
Not all communities track business ownership data by race or ethnicity, so this analysis is limited to a few states. But it matches up with what Robert Fairley is finding in his research, especially earlier in the pandemic. He's a professor of economics at the University of California, Santa Cruz.
I found, for example, in April that 26% of Asian-owned businesses shut down during that month. And then what I found, I also looked at this in May and found that 21% were also closed.
For business owners overall, the drop was 15%. Some of that was just general business conditions when the pandemic hit. Kwa Lei owns K-Vibe Studios in New Jersey.
Boom. And I lost all my corporate contracts. So within about a 2 day to a week span, I lost close to over $500,000.
But he acknowledges in the early days, racism played a role for some Asian-owned businesses as well.
My wife owns a nail salon. When the salons were still open, people would go into the salon and say, hey, are you Chinese? Because if you are, I'm not going to do business.
Now that nail salons are open, Lei says people are lining up to get into his wife's shop. And he's pivoted to more virtual video sessions and says his corporate clients are starting to come back. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
One of the early signs this pandemic was going to turn into a crisis was, and yes, insert the appropriate caveats here, but it was the stock market, from record highs down to plummeting lows in just weeks. And while all that craziness was going on, we talked to Jordan Werfsbrock. She's studying information science at the University of Colorado Boulder. And we talked to her about a project she had done, turning the gyrations of the Dow into something that we could hear. Since then, of course, with only the rare pullback, hello today, traders have decided that this pandemic, yeah, whatever, but we really like the idea of economic data that you could hear. So we called her back to ask her about unemployment, those incredible first-time claims numbers we've been reporting on since March, and the related continuing claims for unemployment benefits. And here's what she sent us. All right, so that is what unemployment in this economy sounded like from February to the beginning of this month. But since most of us aren't really used to listening to data, we have gotten Jordan back on the phone to help sort it all out for us. Jordan, thanks for coming back on.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Okay, so as we did last time, we're going to break this down because it was really interesting to me in our previous conversation how we you had to teach me how to listen, and thus we taught everybody else together how to listen. So
that's right.
Talk to me first of all. Yeah, talk to me first of all about the new first-time claims for unemployment. What are those sounds?
Yeah, so to break this down, the new claims are represented by a harp sound. So one note for each week of data. And as that data increases, as the claims increase, so will the pitch. So that harp sound is going to actually go up as the claims go up. And so it's going to go from actually a really low number. Back in February, there were only about 200,000 new claims in the week of February 1st. And it's going to peak at kind of an astonishing 6.9 million new claims in March.
Okay, so first of all, that was kind of amazing. Second of all, the continued claims, that is people who are still claiming those unemployment benefits. What are those sounds?
Right. So this is going to be a little bit trickier, but I think we got it. So it's going to be represented by a drum set. So for 1 million continued claims, you just hear a single drum. 17 million would be 17 drum sounds. And they're going to be kind of layered on top of each other. And there's one more little sonic wrinkle in there, which is that as you hear more drums, you're going to hear different drums too. So when the numbers are low, so between 0 and 5 million continued claims, it's going to be a rattle drum, drumsticks for 5 to 10 million, tom drum for 10 to 15 million, onto a snare drum for 15 to 20 million, a hi-hat cymbal above 20 million, and then we've got a crash cymbal at the peak, which is nearly 25 million continued claims.
Let's say, just for instance, we had 12 million claims. What would that sound like?
Yeah, so you would hear 12 drum sounds layered on top of each other, and you'd actually hear 5 rattle drums, 5 drumsticks, and then 2 tom drums. So you hear this cacophony of drums building as it gets bigger.
Which is not unlike the way the unemployment claims have been sounding. So let's listen now actually to continued claims during this pandemic-induced recession that we are in. So here we go. Let's listen to this. Okay, so let's roll them all together now, right? We've got the harp sound for the new claims, the layered drum set thing for continuing claims. If we put it all together, and people, everybody listening, you need to concentrate on this. Here's what 2020 has been like. Okay. So do me a favor, would you? And I'm going to guess you have this in your data set somewhere. What does 2009 sound like, just as a point of comparison?
Yeah, so 2009, we're actually going to hear from January through August. And it's going to sound really flat and like it's not changing that much compared to 2020. So I don't know. Another way to put that is what you just heard, 2020, it's like this steep, sudden rise. Whereas 2009, it's so long and so gradual and so drawn out that it's hard to even hear a peak when you listen to it.
All right, so we'll listen to that. Here we go. All right. So look, last thing, and then I'll let you go. And first of all, thank you for doing this for us, because it's a really interesting way to think about the data that we use on this program day in and day out. But I want to ask you, as an information sciences person, what did you learn? What was the challenge? How did you approach this?
Yeah, so it was actually a really tough data set to turn into sound. And it's because 2020 is so astonishing, right? Those unemployment numbers for 2020 were so huge that to make sounds that could capture both the current moment and something like the Great Recession in 2009, it was quite a challenge. And I think that made me reflect on just how kind of unprecedented this current moment really is.
Yeah, it is. Jordan Werf Sprock, she's a PhD student in information sciences at the University of Colorado Boulder. Jordan, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up.
And then they started messing with them. They turned them into sort of office guinea pigs.
Sounds like a nightmare I had last week. First, though, let's do the numbers. Man. Oh, look, the Wawas. How about that? Speaking of sound and economic data, Dow Industrials down 710 points today, 2.7%, 25,445. The NASDAQ down 222 points, 2.1%, 9,909. S&P 500 off 80, about 2.5%, 30,050 there. So given all of that, let us check in, shall we, on some COVID-19 figures. The latest data showed the U.S. is conducting more than 511,000 coronavirus tests every day. New cases reported yesterday, nearly 33,000 in this economy. We've got those numbers from what we are calling the COVID economy on our website, marketplace.org, which is what, by the way, you're listening to. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Given today's news about reclosings and spiking virus numbers, there is a story to be told about bankruptcies in this economy. We've reported on this quite a bit. There is going to be a wave of them coming this year, given everything. But what happens if there are too many of them, if the bankruptcy system just can't handle it all? Marketplace's Sabri Benishour is on that story.
Giant bankruptcies, like the companies that owe more than $100 million, are up 40% from a year ago. Chapter 11 bankruptcies of all kinds are up 20% since last year. This is obviously traumatic for the people who work at these companies, but there is a silver lining.
It's an overstatement to say that bankruptcy is this deeply undesirable thing.
Jared Elias is professor of law at UC Hastings.
One of the great things that happens after bankruptcy is a company leaves and they're hopefully positioned to thrive.
The post-COVID economy is going to be very different, and a lot of businesses will need to radically reinvent and reinvest in themselves in order to adapt. Chapter 11 bankruptcy lets companies do that, which is why Elias and a group of academics are concerned that if there are too many bankruptcies, the courts might get overwhelmed and companies won't get the help they need.
When a company is in financial trouble, they can't invest, they can't hire, they can't give people pay raises, they can't do the things that businesses need to do to be attractive places to work.
So if you slow down the process of transformation, it slows down the entire economy, he says.
There have been proposals to bring back some retired bankruptcy judges, recently retired bankruptcy judges, and then you also would need to add personnel at the clerk's office level as well.
Robert Keech is an attorney with Bernstein Scherer. He says Congress made it a lot easier, faster, and cheaper for small businesses to go through the bankruptcy process through reforms in 2019 and through the CARES Act. But judges take time to hire, and there is only so much you can do, he says. A lot will depend on just how bad the bankruptcy wave will be. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Among the things turned topsy-turvy by this pandemic, other than, you know, like everything, well, healthcare spending. Turns out companies that offer health insurance coverage might be in line to save some money this year as employees have put off elective or non-essential care. But a new survey from the accounting and auditing firm PwC says those companies might be spending more right now on mental health care. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
PwC's Health Research Institute does an annual report on employers' healthcare spending, and there's a big difference this year because of the pandemic. Ben Isger heads the institute.
Employers are making mental health a priority because it really is in their interest to keep their people healthy and working productively.
Isker says the Institute interviewed more than 400 employers and around 12,000 individuals. Almost a third of those workers had accessed mental health care services or were planning to, and employers are offering new benefits.
Health and wellness apps that might help with meditation, stress reduction.
Employees are also having virtual visits with counselors. Isker says employer spending on psychiatry services rose 43% from 2014 to 2018. Joanne Volk at the Georgetown University Center on Health Insurance Reforms says according to the CDC,
one in three people are reporting that they are experiencing either anxiety or depression as a result of COVID-19.
But employer spending on mental health care isn't unlimited. Michael Urban directs the occupational therapy program at the University of New Haven.
They may only cover like one or two visits for you to go talk to someone.
Or require you to pay a hefty deductible. And virtual visits don't work for everyone. Some people craving face-to-face contact during the pandemic need in-person counseling, which can cost employers more. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There is a certain not small percentage of the American workforce that has spent the past 100 days, give or take, living and working and working and living inside the same four walls. How those four walls, those spaces, those inside spaces where we are all spending a lot of time right now affect our health and work is kind of Emily Anthes' thing. She is a science journalist who's got a new book out about the growing body of research into how buildings shape our lives. It's called The Great Indoors. Emily, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I want to skip to chapter four here, which is titled The Cure for the Common Cubicle. And I want to note that a decent proportion of the office workers in this country right now are not actually in their cubicles. What light can you shed on how this new situation we're all trying to deal with is affecting us?
Well, I think that's still a bit of an open question, and there are a lot of studies ongoing right now to try to answer it. But we do know some things about what happens when you take people out of the office. And in particular, we know that sort of the gold standard for communication and collaboration with colleagues remains face-to-face contact, face-to-face interaction. And so that's something that's really been stripped away and stripped away all of a sudden. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see things like teamwork and collaboration maybe take a hit during this time.
Yeah. You talk about some research at a medical records office at the Mayo Clinic, right? Tell us about that research and then what we learned from it.
Absolutely. So I had the chance to go and visit a really unusual lab called the Well Living Lab, which is set up at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. And it looks like your typical open plan office, but there are all these sensors hidden around the office. And so they moved 8 employees over from the Mayo Clinic medical records office, and then they started messing with them. They turned them into sort of office guinea pigs. The researchers watched from this control room down the hall. I should say the workers were wired up too, so they were wearing, heart rate monitors, and they started changing the environment. You know, 1 week maybe it was dark and cold in the office, and the next week it was bright and sunny, but noisy because they piped in conversations through the ceiling, and they just sort of tracked how these employees did.
So two things about it. Number one, it's a little creepy, but number two, the really fascinating part is depending on what task you were doing, these environmental factors affected you differently.
Yeah, that's one of the lessons, is that these environmental factors are really nuanced. And so they learned, for instance, that having lots of daylight and a view out of the window boosted employees' working memory, so they performed better on tasks of short-term memory. But it didn't have any effect on their ability to switch between different tasks and sort of multitask. On the other hand, though, they found that if they changed it so it was sort of cooler and bluer light, that did improve the worker's ability to multitask, but it didn't affect their working memory. So that starts to illustrate how, a factor that's good for, or an environment that's good for one kind of task might not be good for another.
One hates to be cynical here, but the research is not being done, I would imagine, or not being used, I guess, in the end product, to benefit the workers, right? It's for the company so that they can get more productivity out of their workers.
Well, So I think the research itself is neutral, but there is a range in how it can be applied. And companies could apply it to try to make their workers happier, more comfortable, more satisfied, or they could try to use it to sort of wring every last ounce of productivity out of them. And I would not be surprised if we see some of it applied that way.
When eventually we all get back to our offices. The book is called The Great Indoors. It's by science journalist Emily Anthes. Emily, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Sure. Thanks so much.
We've got an excerpt from Emily's book about an apartment design. This one is meant to extend your lifespan. You can find it at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, a rare bit of sunshine from the Internal Revenue Service. The tax filing deadline, as I hope you know, has been extended to July the 15th. And as a result, and thanks to some quirks in the tax code, those who are due refunds will get interest on those checks dated from April the 15th, the original and statutory deadline. That applies, by the way, even to people who haven't filed yet, because we do have another 3 weeks or something, right? So even if you file on the new deadline, say that is July the 15th, and you are due a refund, you get 3 months of interest back to April the 15th. Now, how much interest? I'm glad you asked. Not so bad, actually. 5% compounded daily for the second quarter. That is April, May, and June. 3% compounded daily starting July the 1st. All right, we are out of here. Not without, though, your daily moment of economic context. Remember I said yesterday we had more than 600,000 people go through TSA checkpoints on Monday. First time over 600,000 since March. Don't know if correlation is causation, but with Mariel's story about businesses reclosing firmly in mind, yesterday, down to 470,000 people flying. Our media production team includes Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. Once again, because this is Wednesday, I will say they're the ones going into the studios so that the rest of us can stay inside these four walls. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.